welcome in to another special podcast right here on Sports Talk Chicago. Today, we have a great treat for you as Hall of Fame baseball player Ozzie Smith joins the show in moments to reflect on his amazing career, talk about some MLB Hall of Fame news, and also take a look at his charitable endeavors today. I'm very excited to talk with Ozzie today as I feel that there's so much to be said about his amazing playing days. He's in the Hall of Fame for a reason. He's one of the greatest baseball players of all time, and I can't wait to hear some great stories from his career while also recap history on the baseball diamond. Before we get started, make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram at John Zags, on Twitter at JohnZSports, and now on Facebook at John Zagluel. Today's show is brought to you by Moochie World, where inspiration meets creation. Call 708-247-2100 to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art classes for adults and children. Moochie World, creativity at its finest. And by the Windy City Thunderbolts. Get ready for the team's 2019 season as they celebrate their 20th anniversary. Purchase tickets right now at 708-489-2255. Again, that's 708-489-2255 for your chance to be a part of history this summer in Crestwood. Well, over the years on this podcast, we've been fortunate enough to welcome very distinguished guests from the sports world on this show. I mean, think about it. Roger Clemens, Michael Vick, Fergie Jenkins, and so many more. We've got people from sports media also joining us. Distinguished writers, Hall of Fame writers, in fact. And I'll tell you what. Every time I have someone on the show, it's an honor and a privilege to talk to them, interview them, and learn more about them. It's also an honor to me to bring that content to you and give you an opportunity to learn more about them. Well, today, as I mentioned near the top of the show, this is an interview that you'll never forget. To have the Wizard on today's show, to have someone on with so much history, baseball knowledge, and accolades, it's an extreme honor. And I can't wait for you to listen in to this interview and enjoy every second of it. So again, thank you so much for your support, and I hope you enjoy this interview with an all-time baseball great. It's now time for our special guest. He began his MLB career in 1978 as a member of the San Diego Padres, and by 1981, he made his first of 15 All-Star Game appearances. Just 1 year later, he was traded to the St. Louis Cardinals, where he helped lead the team to a seven-game World Series victory. In 1985, he played postseason hero again, hitting a walk-off home run in Game 5 of the NLCS, thus helping to lead the Cardinals to another World Series appearance. After a career spanning 19 years, 13 Gold Glove Awards, and the greatest defensive war of all time, he retired in 1996. Today, he's a member of the Baseball Hall of Fame and the president of the Gateway PGA Reach Foundation. Please welcome the Wizard himself, Ozzie Smith, to the show. Ozzie, how are you doing today? And thank you for being here. It's an honor.
Well, thank you, John. Thanks for having me on your show, and looking forward to spending a few minutes with you.
Well, to start today, Ozzie, I have to ask about your nickname as I talked about the Wizard. Why the Wizard, and how did you end up getting that nickname? Is there a story behind it?
Well, you know, I don't know if there's a story behind it. In baseball, nicknames are very, very prevalent. And my name is Osborne, so most of my friends in my early days of playing baseball sports, period, everybody called me Oz. And I think they conflated that with the type of plays that I made and the Wizard of Oz. And it's sort of one of those things, John, that's always been there. Hard to explain how and when exactly it started, but it's something that's always kind of been with me. And I think it has to do with the fact that my name was so long, and in baseball we shorten names to come up with nicknames. So here I am, Oz.
So you're given this nickname because of this amazing defense, and rightfully so. I mean, as I mentioned, you've won 13 consecutive Gold Glove Awards. What was your secret? I mean, how were you able to sustain such success on defense and almost master the shortstop position in a way?
Well, John, I think it's just it's pride, it's confidence. It's first of all being blessed with great hand and eye coordination and understanding at an early age that you know, that could be taken at any point, any time. So I never took anything for granted. I worked extremely hard every day knowing that, or feeling that if this was going to be the last day that I had a chance to play, I wanted to be the best. And I just continued to strive to be the very best that I could be day in and day out, as consistent as I could possibly be. And when things were all said and done, you know, things would fall as they may. You know, I set out to be the best that I could be with my God-given talent, and didn't take anything for granted. And every day it allowed me to reach greater heights.
And what I find interesting is that today, you know, you're this all-time great, you're this baseball legend, but during your high school years, you weren't necessarily a top recruit. I mean, when you attended college, you had to walk on to your school's baseball team. What was that journey like you from being a walk-on to now a baseball Hall of Famer?
Well, John, I think it just speaks for all of the young people out there that the road to the big leagues or the road to the Hall of Fame is not an easy one, and it's different one. It's different for everybody. I was not one of those bonus babies. I think that when people see guys that have had a lot of success, they think that, you know, they're bonus babies and the road was easy. I understood very early on that the road was going to be tough. My road to the big leagues was going to be different than somebody else's, and I just had to continue to work hard, put in the blood, the sweat, and the tears, and knowing that no success comes without some blood, some sweat, and tears. And I was willing to put forth that effort, knowing and believing in myself. And you have to have people that believe in you, too, willing to give you the opportunity. And the opportunity for me came in 1976. I was drafted by the Detroit Tigers. And I finished 3 years of my schooling, decided to go back to school in hopes of getting drafted again my senior year, which I did, by the San Diego Padres. And so it's all about believing in yourself and having people that were willing to give you an opportunity. And I was given that opportunity in 1977 when I signed with the San Diego Padres, and, you know, just continued to work, and good things happened.
Ozzie Smith here on Sports Talk Chicago. And Ozzie, you mentioned 1977. I want to jump to 1978, your rookie year. Tell me about what happened in only your 10th game of the season. I mean, you made most arguably one of the greatest fielding plays in MLB history. Tell me what happened on that play and the reaction you received from your teammates.
Well, you know what? Here again, that day started like every other day. You know, we had a afternoon game, and Randy Jones was pitching, and I was just this little small 150-pound kid who had a nose for the baseball. And in this particular instance, Jeff Burrows is hitting. He hits a bullet up the middle. And just as I dive, the ball hits and goes back in the opposite direction that my body is going. And so my glove hand is gone. The only thing I can do is reach back with my bare hand while in the air. Somehow the ball stuck in my hand. I was able to scramble to my feet and throw Jeff Burrows out at first base. And that was the beginning for me as far as recognition is concerned. It wasn't until the next day that I realized that, you know, I had done something special. But for me, it was what I had done that had allowed me to get to the big league. So I wasn't doing anything different than I had already done. I had a nose for the baseball, and I was just tracking it down in that instance. And lo and behold, it stuck in my hand, and I was able to scramble to my feet and make a play.
Later that season, you also introduced your signature backflip, something that I think was very unique and entertaining, to say the least. Where did the idea for the backflips come from, and did you ever imagine it being as popular as it was?
No, John, I never did. It was one of those things growing up in South Central Los Angeles. I lived across the street from a wood factory, so we used to go over and tumble in the sawdust all the time, and as kids, we were always dare. I dare you. I bet you can't do this. I bet you can't do that. So we did some pretty stupid and dangerous things as kids. But fortunate enough for me, I was, I became adept at being able to do it and do it on a consistent basis. So one day after practice, we had to run 2 miles, and I wasn't very fond of running too long distances. My teammates gave me a hard time about being the rookie and being near the back of the pack. So to show the guys that I wasn't tired, I did my my round-off backflip, and it entertained them so much that one of my teammates and the PR guy for the ball club thought it would be a good idea for me to do it on my way out the final day of the season, which was Fan Appreciation Day. I was a little reluctant to do it because, as you know, in San Diego, the chicken was the entertainment. So they coerced me into doing it. People liked it so much, they asked me to do it opening day the following year, and lo and behold, a trademark was born.
Going to 1981, you've been in the league now for 4 years. You just made your first All-Star team and set the single-season record for most assists by a shortstop. So what happened with you and the Padres organization, and when you were traded to St. Louis, what were your thoughts on it at the time?
Well, you know, at the time, I think I was a three-year player at the time. And at that particular time for San Diego, it was like a revolving door. And from a contract standpoint, they weren't willing to pay me because they felt at the time that I was a one-dimensional player. And the San Diego was, they were looking for a better offensive shortstop. And Gary Templeton had some problems here in St. Louis, and that really kind of made the deal. You know, he was the offensive shortstop that they were looking for. I was the defensive shortstop the St. Louis Cardinals were looking for. Hence the trade was made, and we were the two principals in the trade, but it turned out well for both of us because I think Gary and the Padres got a chance to probably one of their only chances for postseason play. So he had a pretty good career there in San Diego, and I had a pretty good one here in St. Louis.
So you start spring training in 1982 with your new team in St. Louis, and your manager at the time, Whitey Herzog, wanted to find a way to improve your offensive production. Tell me about the wager that you guys made and how it worked out for you.
Well, you know, here I was a guy that he wanted me to be able to take advantage of my speed. And so for me to do that, I had to keep the ball out of the air because for some reason, anytime I hit the ball in the air, people thought I was trying to hit a home run. Well, I was never given credit for being smarter than that and knowing that I was not a home run hitter. I just had not had any real formal teaching as far as offense was concerned. I could put the ball in play, but learning to keep the ball out of the air was the important thing, or stay on top of the ball, which is the thing that he and some of the coaches that he assigned to me taught me how to stay on top of the ball and keep the ball out of the air. And for every ground ball I hit, he would give me a dollar. For every fly ball I hit, I'd give him a dollar. Well, with that being an incentive, midway the season, he said, this thing is over. So I learned very quickly at how to keep the ball out of the air, which allowed me to use more of my speed. And it really allowed me to be more effective as an offensive player.
And later that season, you guys had made it all the way to the World Series. You had forced a Game 7 against Milwaukee. In the sixth inning of that game, the Cardinals were down 3-1, and it seemed like maybe this wasn't going to be your year. What changed during that game, and what was it like for you to then come back and win the World Series with your team?
Well, it was great, you know, because that's what we all strive for. You know, we strive to be a part of something that is bigger than yourself. And when you have 25, 30 different personalities that you're dealing with, when you win and you win at that level, the achievement is one of great accomplishment because you were able to do it as a team. And winning with the group of guys that we had, you know, I was fortunate here in St. Louis that I got a chance to experience the World Series three times. And you don't get a chance to do that unless you have good teammates. And Whitey Herzog surrounded me with a lot of good teammates, and we played well together. We played off of each other, and we took a lot of pride in what we did each and every day. And in the long run, over 15 years here, you know, having the opportunity that I did was more than I could ever have dreamed of. Just getting an opportunity to play professionally was very, very special in and of itself. But to experience it at that level, at that high of a level, and then, you know, have that being capped off by being elected to the Hall of Fame after a 15-year career is very, very, very special.
Well, the postseason heroics didn't end with you there and the Cardinals, as in 1985, you hit a walk-off home run to win Game 5 of the NLCS. So first off, tell me about what happened in that moment and how you were able to come through for your team in such a clutch situation. And secondly, what did you think about Jack Buck's call when you first heard it?
Well, John, I tell you, you know, in 1985, I had a chance to meet. I was always a guy that had worked extremely hard with lifting weights and doing all of those things that to keep yourself strong over a 162-game schedule. But I had the good fortune of meeting a guy by the name of Mackie Shieldstone. Mackie Shieldstone took Michael Spinks from a light heavy to a heavyweight. And in visiting with Mackie, I told him what I was trying to accomplish. I was trying to put two halves together. You know, I would get off to a good start, and midway of the season, you know, everything that I'd worked on in the offseason was gone. So he helped me with nutrition, weight training, and really, he taught me about how to eat for life, not just for a season. So I'd gotten a lot stronger. I'd learned how to pull the ball down in the corner. I got stronger, not necessarily hit the ball out of the ballpark, but to back the defense up. And the Dodgers would always pitch me in, and I'd learned how to turn on the ball. I continued to work hard on the fundamental aspects of it. And in that instance, I wasn't really trying to hit the ball out of the ballpark. I was just trying to get myself in scoring position. He supplied the power. I supplied the technique. And Jack Buck happened to be on the mic at that particular time. Smith corks one down the line. Could go. Go crazy, folks. Go crazy. The Cardinals have won the game by the score of 3-2 on a home run by the Wizard. I've heard that 1,000 times. I feel like I've hit 500 home runs on that call. And probably one of the best moments I ever had was that I was doing a card show one day, and I had a little kid come up to the table who could barely peep over a table. His name was Slade. And his mom said to him, "Why don't you do it for him?" The little kid came up, and he did that word for word. And she said that every time they get in the car, they had to put that tape on, and he did that. He memorized that whole thing. So it was pretty neat, and it's great to have been a part of that Cardinal moment.
And after winning the NLCS that year, you guys advanced to the World Series. You come in as favorites and take a 3-2 series lead before the infamous blown call at first base by Don Denkinger. What did you see at your vantage point from shortstop, and why do you think that the call ended the Cardinals' World Series hopes in a way that year?
Well, you know, it's one of those things that you look back on it, and, you know, looking at today's play, you know, with instant replay, if we'd had the instant replay back then, we probably would be wearing another ring. But I don't think it was as much the call as it was how Mr. Denkinger reacted. He didn't even ask for any help. And I got to all Whitey and everybody on the club wanted was just ask somebody else, did they see something different? And they were reluctant to do that. And the reluctance to do that is where tempers really flared. And I think it was one of the reasons that Whitey and Joaquin both got kicked out of the game. It was the mere fact that he wouldn't ask for any help.
Do you think he should have asked for help? Do you feel that maybe he was a little too proud to ask for help and that could have hurt you guys as well? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are that it at best, if that's the case, if that's what the other umpire saw, then fine. I think it leaves a bitter taste in your mouth, the fact that he did not ask for help and just became the judge, jury, and executioner all by himself.
And after that World Series loss, you were able to make it back one more time in a losing effort to the Minnesota Twins. Do you regret not getting the chance to win another World Series after 1982, especially with that blown call in the back of your mind, then the loss against the Twins later?
Well, you know what? It always hurts. But, you know, along the way, you get a lot of breaks. We got a lot of breaks along the way as well and stuff. You just kind of make them. And, you know, you look back at 1985, there was a foul ball afterwards that if we make that play, you know, we probably get out of that inning because that was the only game all year that with a lead into the eighth inning that we did not win. You know, so, you know, things happen for a reason. Do we wish we could have won that? Yes, we do. But, you know, we had a chance and we didn't take advantage of it. Same thing in 1987. You know, we won every game at home and they won every game at their place and stuff. So it's just the way the ball bounces sometimes. And I feel very lucky and very fortunate that I had the opportunity to go three times. We won it all once and stuff because there's some guys never get to experience that. And so I'm very blessed to have had the opportunity to experience it.
Moving to 1996, the Cardinals had gone through a transition, and you guys hadn't made the playoffs since 1987. Their idea, however, of switching things up in 96 had to do with demoting you for the likes of Royce Clayton. Did you agree with that decision at the time, and were you unhappy with the fact that the Cardinals forced you out in a way?
I was, you know what, here again, I was unhappy, and I don't want to bring up all of those, all of the stuff that went on then. I was just frustrated at the fact that I was not given the opportunities I said that I was going to, I was told that I was going to be given. And it was that frustration because at the time, I think I probably could have, it was portrayed that I was like a guy in a wheelchair being rolled out to shortstop. I was still very, very effective as a shortstop because I worked extremely hard to keep myself in a in decent enough position to be able to help my club in some shape, form, or fashion. And it didn't work out. Doesn't always work out the way you want it. But you know what? I had a wonderful 19-year career, and I don't think that that tainted the way that people looked at me and the way I went about my job every day.
Well, you mentioned your wonderful career, and of course, once your career ended in 2002, you received election into the Baseball Hall of Fame. How much did that honor mean to you, and what does it say about you and your journey to baseball immortality?
Well, it just meant that, and here again, I never looked at myself as a Hall of Fame. The Hall of Famers were those, they were those guys, you know, the Koufaxes, the Gibsons, the Brocks, the Musials. You know, I never looked at myself in that same vein. All I knew is that I wanted an opportunity to play professionally. And if I could go out and be consistent and do my job to the best of my ability every day, then, you know, what happened after that, you know, was out of my control. You know, I had to control what I could control. And that's what I did over 19 years. I was as consistent as I could possibly be. I knew that every day that I left the ballpark, I asked myself the question, did I do the very best that I could do that day? And for 19 years, that answer was yes. I didn't leave anything out there. I knew that when I left the ballpark that night, even if we didn't win, I knew that I had given it all that I had that particular day. And I think that was what people appreciated, or people continue to appreciate about this organization. They know that we can't win every day. They just look for the effort day in and day out, and that's what I tried to give.
And today you're still involved with the Hall of Fame as a member of the Veterans Committee, which recently elected Lee Smith and Harold Baines, which is a decision that has angered some advocates for a more exclusive Hall of Fame. What is your response to those claims, and what are your thoughts on Baines and Smith getting in?
Well, you know, here again, it's kind of a fail-safe way to make sure that the writers didn't miss on guys getting into the Hall of Fame. Now, I didn't get a chance to play with Harold Baines. I saw him from a distance, and he certainly was a great player. I had a chance to play with Lee Smith, and when Lee Smith retired as the top saves leader in the game. You know, things have changed since he retired, but it was always baffling to me as to why he was always overlooked. So having had the opportunity to play with Lee Smith, I knew that he was very, very deserving of being in the Hall of Fame. And certainly, you know, having played with Raleigh Fingers, Bruce Sutter, Todd Worrell, Dennis Eckersley, and Lee Smith certainly belonged in that class.
What are your thoughts on steroid players getting in the Hall of Fame? I know that this isn't necessarily a Veterans Committee problem at the moment, but when it does become one, do you see guys like Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens getting in? And more importantly, do you think they deserve to be in?
Well, you know what? Before they were associated with steroids, those two guys, I think that you mentioned, Roger and Barry, were certainly Hall of Famers. And unfortunately, you know, they got caught up in the steroid era, and I think everybody has their own personal feelings about it. For me, you know, if you break the rules, then, you know, you have to pay the consequences, and they certainly are because they were associated with that. And as a Hall of Famer, you know, you don't want to be associated with with something as negative as that. And, you know, so here we are. It appears that we have gotten a grip on it. And as we go forward here, I'm sure that you'll probably see some guys' numbers continue to creep up. And who knows, maybe one day they will. The other question that always comes up is that, what about Pete Rose? Well, you know, Pete Rose, I don't think, did anything that changed numbers as far as the game is concerned. So if you allow steroid guys to be in the Hall of Fame, then Pete Rose certainly deserves to be in the Hall of Fame for what he was able to accomplish on the baseball field.
Would you be willing to disclose your ballot as to the Veterans Committee? Like, how does that voting process work? And if you don't mind, did you want to disclose who you voted for or how that works?
No, we don't usually tell who we voted for and stuff, because as you can imagine, that would, you know, that could get out of hand very quickly, you know. So we try and keep that as private as possible and stuff. But the two guys that made it because they got enough votes through the committee to be elected into the Hall of Fame.
And before we let you go today, Ozzie, I wanted to ask you about your work with the Gateway PGA Reach Foundation. What's the foundation's mission? How did you get involved, and how did you become the president of it?
Well, you know, as we retire from the game of baseball, we're always looking for that thing that's going to fill that competitive void in your life. And I think most of us gravitate to the game of golf because it has to do with hand and eye coordination and hitting something, which we become accustomed to over 19, 20 years. And golf fills that void because you're competing against yourself, you're competing against the course, and you're competing against the guys that you play against. So for me, I was no different. I started playing the game when I retired in 1996. I fell in love with it, and I had a friend of mine who had introduced me to the game, said that the Gateway chapter of the PGA here in St. Louis needed a face, as somebody who was going to be able to help bring more awareness to their cause and help them raise money. And hence, that's how I became the president of the Gateway chapter of the PGA, which now our long-range goal is to build a 9-hole multi-recreational golf facility in the inner city for kids. Growing up in South Central Los Angeles, I was never exposed to the game of golf. And through this process and being president, I realized that it's not just exposing the kids to it, to the game of golf, but the business of golf as well, while at the same time using golf as the hook. Education is probably the most important aspect of it. And we feel that golf is so time-consuming that it will allow kids the opportunity to hopefully become better citizens the longer we keep them in school.
Well, Ozzie, thank you so much for being here on the show today. Again, such an honor, and please come back soon. I really appreciate it.
All right, John. Thank you very much for having me.
What an honor it was to have the Hall of Famer Ozzie Smith on today's show as we talk with him about his amazing playing career, his role on the Veterans Committee, and, of course, his philanthropic efforts with the PGA Tour. And I'll say this, having someone on like Ozzie Smith here today is an extreme honor, and I hope you enjoyed our conversation. Well, that does it for us here at Sports Talk Chicago. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at @ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram at John Zags, on Twitter at John Z Sports, and now on Facebook at John Zaglua. Also, make sure to subscribe to the website. You can find the subscription box on the homepage of the site. Simply type in your email, click yes on the confirmation email, and from there, you'll be subscribed. You'll receive every new podcast and article directly to your email. And remember, Sports Talk Chicago is now on iTunes and Google Play. Simply search Sports Talk Chicago, and every podcast from the 2018-19 calendar year is now available. Feel free to leave us a 5-star rating and or write a review. Your support is greatly appreciated. And finally, if you enjoyed today's podcast, tune in to my new radio show every Monday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. on 88.5 WHBK-FM Chicago. You'll still hear my same hard-hitting Chicago sports opinions. Plus, we'll add special segments and, of course, very special guests on each show. Again, that's every Monday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. on 88.5 WHBK-FM Chicago. Thank you again for listening in to today's show, and have a great day.